He's great. The one, obviously, Ms. Bray. Judge, I'd like to respectfully reserve about 3 minutes for
rebuttal. All right, that'll be fine.
This case is obviously much less complicated than the last one. The crux of the argument is basically that the statute that requires proof of prior convictions, specifically in this case, we're referring to the ones for possession of a firearm and attempted possession that Mr. Cartagena was convicted of. The statute itself reads that a person must be convicted of a felony whether such conviction occurred under the law of Virginia or any other state. And I've taken that, obviously, and just pulled out the relevant portions. Our argument is that the statute does not say whether the felony occurred under the laws of another state. This is whether the conviction occurs under the laws of another state.
You concede he has a felony conviction under the laws of the state of New York.
Absolutely.
And so if under the laws of any other state means that, you lose all three arguments.
Yes. The crux of the argument, which it must rise or fall on, here is what the meaning and the way you read that particular statute. So the argument is that the statute itself says what is talking about the convictions. That can occur under another state. It doesn't say whether the felony occurs from another state. So our particular statute defines what a felony is by punishment. And obviously, I cited the Turner case. I know the court, and I will rely on my brief. I won't.
Well, in Virginia, in the common law, felony is any offense that carries a potential punishment of more than a year. And isn't that substantially the same definition New York has, even if we have to get to that point?
It is the same as New York, but that is not evidence that was ever introduced.
Well, but we can take judicial notice of it.
The court can, yes.
In fact, under Virginia Rule of Evidence 2202, it says we shall do that.
Yes, and the court absolutely can.
And I find it interesting because my reading of the document that was introduced says he pled guilty to attempted assault in the second degree. And the argument at trial says that's a Class D felony. However, if a court is allowed to look at New York law, and you look at Penal Law Section 100.5, you find that in New York that, of course, the attempt reduces the level of offense. And so it's not a Class D felony. It's a Class E felony, which for our purposes, felony is felony, but if it had been a Class E felony, if it had been an attempt at a Class E felony, and that's all that had been introduced to trial and nobody else had done anything, would we be able to say, well, since it's an attempt, New York law says you reduce that offense, that would have made it a misdemeanor. Could we do that?
John, I don't believe so.
Why not?
I believe, well, if it's an error in law actually reading, I think the court absolutely could.
But
I don't think the court could change the conviction on that. I think the court is allowed to take judicial notice, but we're talking about is sufficiency of what was introduced for the trial court.
Well, right, but if it says attempted and then class E felony. This one says Class D felony, but it was an attempt is the conviction. So that makes it, under New York law, it's not a Class D felony conviction, it's a Class E felony conviction. Which in this case is still a felony conviction.
Right.
But if the argument is that the court, since nobody introduced New York Penal Law 100.5, could a court take judicial cognizance of that? And the reason I'm asking is I'm thinking of the next case where there's an attempt at a Class E felony in New York, but that's the same documentary evidence is introduced. Nobody raises that since it's an attempt, you reduce it a level, and it's actually not a felony. Would we be able to set aside a felon in possession conviction if it turns out it really isn't a New York felony?
Judge, I think that would happen through a habeas, most appropriately. I think if that was something that was not drawn at the trial court.
I suspect we're without authority to collaterally attack one of our sister states.
But it's not a collateral attack.
And I agree. And nowhere are we attacking the conviction itself. The argument here is that the Commonwealth is required to introduce evidence of the punishment. It's a simple standard, and I'm not suggesting that had they done that, they wouldn't have been able to do that.
Now, if the court's allowed to take judicial notice, including the appellate court, of the potential punishment range, consistent with Judge Humphrey's question, don't we have the answer to that question? And under 2:202, why can't we?
Judge, the argument that I have is the court can take judicial notice, but there was no evidence of that in the court.
Well, except we have the offense, we have the grade of the offense, and the punishment range in New York, much like in Virginia, is set by statute. I can go look it up. It's a question of law. It's not an adjudicative fact.
which I agree with, Judge. And I, as the court knows, the trial court was actually asked to take judicial notice of the punishment.
And
there was an error.
But it didn't say one way or the other.
Correct, which I think the record is required that they have some type of acknowledgement that they are doing that.
On facts, I think you're right. Under 2201, I think you're right. But this is law, right? This is 2202.
Yes, Judge. Judge, I do think that they're required to introduce it, though. I don't think it's sufficient. I think that that would have required the court. I mean, the assumption is the court is doing their job. I think it would require reversal because that, and nothing was introduced, no arguments were made. The trial court erred by not even taking notice of that. Could it have been remedied? Yes, absolutely, Judge. But I don't think it's sufficient at this stage. And this, though this court can take notice of it, I don't think it's going to overcome the sufficiency.
Well, in terms of giving plain meaning to the statute, and maybe we don't even need to get, you know, do the exercise Judge Russell and I have been talking about for the last 5 minutes. But the statute says, quote, under the laws of the Commonwealth or any other state, close quotes. Now, and the reference is to the proof of a felony conviction elsewhere. So I understand your argument to be the words any other state do not modify the words felony conviction. Is that correct?
Judge, the way that the statute is written is it says any person convicted of a felony, whether such conviction occurred under the laws of Virginia.
But if I understand, I mean, your argument, it seems to me, only works if we construe the statute to mean we have to look at whatever the conduct is in the other state that resulted in the conviction and determine if that would be a felony in Virginia. Otherwise, we're done.
And that's incorrect. I don't believe that the reading of the statute...
Well, if that's not correct, then why are we having this discussion right now? Because it seems to me the fact that there's a certified court record from New York saying that your client was convicted of a felony, whatever of whatever class, ends the discussion, doesn't it?
Judge, the argument is that our statute defines what a felony is by punishment. There's case law, obviously, mm-hmm. in support of that. The issue we have here is the statute under which my client was convicted that says that if he has been convicted of a felony, whether such conviction occurred and that under the laws of another state. It doesn't say whether such felony occurred.
But it also doesn't say he has been convicted of a Virginia felony. It just says felony.
Correct. Because that's defined in statute, so I don't think they need to redefine what a felony is. Our code defines what a felony is. So I think there's an assumption. I think the Turner case is very... dispositive, a great example of that. Because if we were just looking at what other states classify...
Well, an extreme example, let's say some state makes jaywalking a Class 6 felony or the equivalent of a Class 6 felony. I mean, that's obviously a public policy Virginia has chosen not to adopt, but it seems to me by reference, if you've been convicted of jaywalking in that state and there's a court record that supports that, you can't buy a gun in Virginia, can you?
Not if the punishment is more than a year, absolutely not. So the question is not what laws are they substantially similar, because I know that was an argument that was made by the Commonwealth. That's not the analysis here, and that's also not the argument. The argument is that the statute says that whether you're convicted of a felony and whether the conviction occurs, but it's the definition of what a felony is. It doesn't say whether the felony occurred under the laws of another state. It says whether that conviction occurred. So the argument is that we know what a felony is.
Is the document that was introduced not a conviction record?
It is a conviction.
Okay,
correct.
And it's from New York,
correct.
Which is another
what
state?
What we're missing, though, is enough evidence, enough information to determine whether it was a felony.
You believe that a convicted of a felony, you believe that there is an implicit convicted of the equivalent of a Virginia felony?
No.
Okay. So the time served is equivalent to a Virginia. The time that could be imposed. We're getting bigger on what's implied. It's that the potential time that could be imposed for the conviction would be a felony sentence in Virginia, whether under the laws of the Commonwealth. That's a lot to imply into that statute.
Well, I think it's what they wrote in there. Felony is already defined by another statute. So when they said whether convicted of a felony, comma, whether such conviction occurred under the laws of Virginia or another state, they could have clearly put whether such felony occurred under the laws of Virginia or another state.
Had they done that? Let's assume for a moment that what he was convicted of, although New York classifies it a felony, could not have been punished by a year in prison.
In New York.
Right. Let's assume that for a moment, and so that would be in your sweet spot. The form he fills out, the Virginia form, your argument then follows, he doesn't have to check felony because the sentence isn't long enough to be a felony in Virginia, but he's also filing a federal firearms form at the same time. If you're right, he would truthfully answer no on the Virginia form to the felony question, but would have to answer yes to the federal firearms felony question, correct?
Judge, so Our argument is not necessarily that. I don't think...
Well, can you answer my question? Wouldn't he have to? Because it's clearly a New York felony, and the feds are, don't care about what the Virginia definition of felony is.
So, yes, he needs to answer yes to both of them, would be my argument. If I were counseling him about how to fill out both forms, I would say to put yes.
Well, if the truthful answer is yes to both forms, then how do you possibly prevail on the argument that he didn't accurately answer the question on the form?
The argument is that they're required to prove that he has a prior felony conviction. So it's really a sufficiency argument based on that conviction order and whether that's enough. There really is no argument about whether he had a prior conviction. And again, I'm not saying it's truthful. What I would counsel him as an attorney is to answer yes on both of those forms. As obviously, I think would have been wise.
Attorney advice tends to be risk averse. I think that's a good idea.
So if I understand your argument, is that essentially it comes down to the evidence is insufficient because the court order from New York does not expressly state what the potential punishment in New York is so that it can be compared to Virginia. Is that correct?
Or that was not introduced. For example, had the court taken additional notice or something, that evidence needed to be introduced of that. I think that easily...
No, you're saying it's insufficient on that basis.
Correct.
Is that right? Okay.
That is the right
thing. I have a couple record questions just to make sure I understand.
Yes, sure.
The car he was driving in at the time of his arrest, the statement from the officer was, I had warrants, outstanding warrants for the registered owner of the car. That's why I pulled the vehicle over and I confirmed identity. Mr. Cartagena was the registered owner of the car, and the warrants that are being referenced in that discussion are, in fact, warrants that were issued because, as a result of him being kicked out on the background check for the firearm application at Liberty Pond, correct?
Correct.
I understand that correctly.
That is correct, yeah. Right. They were the two previous charges.
Right. And he got those because when state police called back, they said...
Correct. He was charged.
He's got a felony in New York.
That's correct.
Okay.
I have one last thing. There was a motion that was filed regarding post-trial bond pending appeal.
Yes, Judge.
I'm not sure quite off the top of my head when that actually was filed. It didn't get referred to this panel until just a couple of weeks ago, and the Commonwealth hadn't had an opportunity to respond, I don't believe. So we went ahead and docketed it for today. It may all be moot by the merits of the appeal at this point, but I thought I'd just mention that. I don't know if you wanted to take a moment to address that.
Yes,
or not.
Judge, thank you. And we would be asking for bond. As the court can see, it was filed later. So the sentence obviously began at the end of last year, December, I believe, of 2016. Once this was granted, my client did request bond, and we did have that hearing. That was recently, I think, in July and August. There were two hearings that were conducted of this year. And we would still be asking for those.
Why would it be moot? I mean, if we affirm the conviction, it's moot. And if we reverse the conviction, it would be on a sufficiency basis. It's reversed in final judgment. So why do we need to act on the bond motion?
If it's reversed, I think it would be moot, but obviously there's no way to know that in advance. If it's denied, however, he does intend to continue his appeal on to the Supreme Court judge. So we'd be asking. I don't know, as the courts, I'm sure, Your Honors have had a chance to review. The reason we had two bond hearings is because the Commonwealth had argued at the bond hearing that the judge no longer had jurisdiction to hear a bond hearing for appeal because my client was in DOC. Once case law was kind of argued and reviewed, we put it back on, and that's still how the trial court felt that, and I think I quoted what he said, that, again, I don't like it. As I said, I prefer he be on bond, so hopefully the Court of Appeals will correct me if I'm wrong. So he was not granted bond at that time. I do think it's still appropriate because in the event that this court were to deny the petition, we'd still be asking for it. I think everything's pretty summed up. I'd just like to draw to the court's attention the fact that my client was on bond for almost a year previously and had no issues with pretrial and those things. His housing, working, everything is still the same. His family's still on bond.
Thank you, Judge. Ms. Stern.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm going to address that bond motion real quick first. And I would just like to say, from my review of the records, it's not clear to me that there was a motion to suspend or postpone execution of judgment, which would, I think, be, and that's under 19.2.319. That is definitely something that needs to be done in order for the court to consider bond or bail pending appeal. And it's not at all clear to me that that was done in this case, and particularly since the bond motion came on late in the games. So after, I think, the defendant was transferred into DOC, I think that's where the argument
goes, that the court, since the execution wasn't, there wasn't a motion by the defense to suspend or postpone execution of judgment, then I think that possibly precludes the granting of bond. If the court looks at the merits of the bond issue, then it does appear that the trial court gave the defendant pretrial bond, and under 19.2.3.19, the presumption, there's a presumption under 19.2.1.20, which deals with pretrial bonds, that there's a presumption against bond for firearms offenses under the code sections that we're working under. When you look at 3.19, and let me back up and say, under 19.2.1.20, there's also a separate code section for violent felony offenses, presumption against. But then you get into 3.19, yes.
On this record, can we get to the merits of the bond issue given the trial court's ruling? Or if we think that he could have on the merits, would we have to remand it?
I think at the end of the day, there should be a remand to the court to now, the language of 3.19 and 5.82 talk about remand to the court to set a bond. So it's tricky, I think. It's not clear to me, which is why I go back to, well, whether 19.2.3.19 is a trigger that allows the court to keep the defendant out of DOC and in the jurisdiction of the court.
Well, I think 3.19 clearly doesn't limit the authority of the court to those who are just haven't been transferred yet, unlike, you know, some of our other cases. Neely comes to mind.
Right.
But, and it also seems to me that there's a shall in there that says the court shall set a bond pending an appeal unless the crime meets certain criteria. And
yes.
I guess the question is whether this one does.
So the court did, you know, I'm stuck with this. The court did make a statement that if he didn't have jurisdiction, that he would grant bond. So
here you're basically conceding it had jurisdiction.
If it had jurisdiction, yes. So that's the record
right. We
have, and I submit that to the court. But bringing those code sections to the court's attention, I thought was important. I'm going to go straight to Judge Russell's question on the merits issue. Judge Russell, you indicated something to the effect that if you could determine from taking judicial notice of the New York code sections that what the defendant was convicted of was in effect a misdemeanor versus a felony.
Well, that's a hypothetical.
Okay,
because
that's
in this one,
because
this one it's still a felony.
Absolutely. So that's my first line argument that on the face of this conviction order, which is on page 164 of the record, it plainly shows that this conviction was for a felony. Now, I think the court, to answer your question, I think the court would be guided by looking at the Farnsworth case, which is cited in our brief, as to what you do if there's a discrepancy between this document and you taking judicial notice of the New York Code. And I would say that under the analysis applied in Farnsworth, you would go by the face of this certified order,
I don't think there's a discrepancy, though. Because as I read the certified document, it says he has been convicted of an attempt of second degree assault being a Class D felony. That doesn't say he's been convicted of a Class D felony. It says he has been convicted of an attempt of a Class D felony, which then, under New York law, is a Class E felony.
Yes.
It's academic here because either one of them is a felony.
Yes. But to speak to the nut of your hypothetical, so if our point simply is, if this is just flat wrong, what do we do? What is, and I think the defendant would be obligated to go back and say, this conviction order is wrong. We need to get this addressed in New York.
I think Judge Russell's point is that somebody needs to take judicial notice of the laws of New York, because
Absolutely.
That's the only way we can determine whether what he was convicted of is a felony under the laws of New York.
If you get to that point in this record, the court can take judicial notice. I'm simply pointing to if there's some error, and which I thought that maybe I read too much into your question.
No, you did. I don't think there's an error.
Okay.
I think there was an error when it was argued below, and everybody said he's convicted of a Class D, although the court reporter at one point called it a Class V felony, which New York does not have. I took judicial notice of that.
Well,
it wasn't a Class D conviction. It's actually a Class E conviction because it's an attempt conviction.
But the bottom line is the conviction order itself states it is a felony conviction. We don't go behind that conviction order. I think that's the way to go. And I think, as I said, under Farnsworth, the analysis applied in that case directs the court in that direction. Back to the merits of the case, and I'm not going to belabor this. Under 18.2308.2, the statute says it's unlawful for any person who's been convicted of a felony, whether such conviction occurred under the laws of the Commonwealth or any other state, to possess a firearm, transport a firearm, possess ammunition of a firearm. It's our position that the language of the statute is plain and unambiguous. The certified conviction order entered into evidence in this case shows that the defendant was previously convicted of a felony under New York law. So the evidence was sufficient to prove the falsification of the firearm consent form, as well as the possession of a firearm by a convicted felon and the attempted possession of a felon by a firearm. Excuse me, I had that all backwards. The attempted possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. So,
the Commonwealth's position is that the language convicted of a felony, whether such conviction occurred under the laws of the Commonwealth or any other state, necessarily means that the words felony and conviction mean in whatever state, you know, by whatever policy is devised by our sister states that chooses to make certain conduct a felony, that's the end of the
analysis. If it's a felony, it's a felony, it's a felony.
Isn't that the only way you can read that? Because no act committed in New York could possibly be a felony under Virginia law. Because Virginia
Can we take notice of that one, too?
Virginia laws could not apply to an act, legal or illegal, committed within New York, with some rare exception to something that overreaches some kind of long arm theory.
Absolutely, Judge Baumgartner, absolutely right. And again, as we pointed out on brief, had the legislature wished or intended to make the Virginia law the touchstone for its analysis, it certainly clearly could have done that, and it has done so in other code sections where they have required they've used the substantially similar language, and we've made that argument on brief.
Your opponent has very skillfully taken a prior decision of this court dealing with a very anomalous situation under the Uniform Court of Military Justice and crafted a very creative argument as to why felony doesn't mean felony. I want to give you an opportunity to explain to me why Turner doesn't apply here.
The Turner case simply doesn't apply because under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, that code does not classify offenses as felonies or misdemeanors. So you have to look into the code in order to determine what is a felony for purposes of 308.2. It doesn't classify, and that's the key.
Whether this court was right or wrong in interpreting how the General Assembly would have applied 18.2308.2 UCMJ violations, it doesn't give us the power to rewrite the plain language of the statute now.
Yes, and I don't think there was any real intent for that to happen in the Turner, that was certainly not the intent of the Turner analysis. So we submit, for the reasons we've stated on brief and the arguments we've made this morning, that the conviction was proper. The legislature could have used substantially similar language in this code section as it has in others. I've argued bond motion. Are there any questions? We ask the convictions be affirmed. Thank you.
Ms. Bray, do you have a little bit of time left?
I'm here for the
Your Honors, with regard to the bond motion, I will let the court know, and I can cite on both transcripts with where 19.2 through 19 was referenced, and it was made clear to the court that I was asking that he suspend the execution. If the court needs that, I can give you the reference points.
I would love to have those references.
Absolutely. And the July 25th, 2017 transcript, it is on page 3, about halfway down. On the August 8th, 2017 transcript, it is on, I apologize, back and forth. It is on page 7. And those are my arguments referencing if that's what we were asking.
You give me transcript citations. Did they make those? They make it into the appendix. Do I have those?
Judge, so these were copies were sent off. It's different. So it's
I
not
think
part
that,
of
yeah, they're separate. They're, I think they're part of the record for the bond motion, not part of the regular appeal.
Okay.
Correct. They're not in the appendix, but they were sent over separately. So you should have those pages. I apologize for that. And in terms, just to clarify, I think what Turner makes clear in my, the whole argument, which I know I see where I'm at, I'm on the opposite side of everybody else on this, is that the statute, when it says whether the prior conviction occurs under a different law, it could have easily been written whether the felony occurs under the laws of another state and such. By not doing that, it makes it clear, and I think Turner kind of implicitly implies that it doesn't matter whether the whether somebody else calls it a felony or not, because in Turner, that's what they said. Even though the judicial code for the military does not classify them, it doesn't mean that that's the way we're looking at it, and that's basically our argument in this case. And I won't belabor, I think. I'll rely on the brief for everything else.
Thank you. We'll come down and recounsel. And